It is Monday, June 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, looking for common ground in the Iran nuclear negotiations.
There remains a significant gap between the Western position and the Iranian position.
Also ahead, more violence ahead of today's election in Burundi, and we'll have the latest on the deadly attack on Tunisia's beach. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held a series of talks with chief Iranian negotiators and some world powers involved in the Iran nuclear talks Sunday in Vienna. Meantime, an unnamed senior U.S. official said all parties at the talks expect to negotiate past a self-imposed June 30th deadline. VOA's Victor Beatty asked University of Denver scholar Jonathan Adelman if he's surprised by this.
Not at all. I think it would have been a shock to everyone. The problems have long been that there have been lots of negotiations. This is the third or fourth time they have been, you know, prolonged and gone past the deadline, because there remains a significant gap, as the French foreign minister said this week, and the British also, between the Western position and the Iranian position.
Is the gap one issue or is it multiple issues?
It's so many issues that it's about five or six. Some of them are off the table now, like ICBMs, which the Iranians are advanced. But a number of the others are not. For example, sanctions. The Iranians want sanctions lifted, and they want them lifted very quickly after this agreement is signed. The Western position of the P5 plus one is that they can only be lifted as there is evidence that Iran is complying with these agreements. Another critical issue is nuclear inspections. There is no question that Iran has a long history of developing nuclear weapons. They're very close, everyone agrees, with less than a year, maybe 3 to 6 months, of having an atomic bomb. There needs to be two things: inspections to guarantee, then those inspections that will be held anywhere, anytime, any place, because they have every reason to avoid that. And secondly, an explanation of how they got there, because they have violated a series of UN resolutions over the years. And there's a number of others as well. There's the whole issue of terrorism. State Department just came out branding Iran as one of the major terror states. This has been largely ignored, but obviously it's very important. And finally, the Grand Ayatollah himself. He just came out 2 days ago and made clear that he was not willing to make concessions on any of these. Now, was that simply for local political consumption in Tehran, or is he very serious about that? Only time is going to tell.
Any significance to the departure of Iran's foreign minister Zarif back to Tehran after discussions in Vienna?
Yeah, I think the problem is you could read it both ways. You could read it that they are really very disgusted in Tehran with what's going on. They had expected things to be easier for them. But then they announced that he's coming back on Tuesday to Vienna to meet with Kerry. So clearly what's going on is he has very little power. In fact, the President Rouhani has very little power. The ultimate power has always been and remains, as it did with the original Grand Ayatollah Khomeini and now with Khamenei, with the religious establishment, as strange as that may seem to many people in the West. And he has been very clear 2 days ago that he's not going to accept any of this. Now, how much is real and how much is just posing is very hard to say, but it does mean that for one more time we've come down to the end and we are nowhere near a conclusion one way or the other.
So this deal is far from over, and is it perhaps getting increasingly into jeopardy as time goes by?
Perhaps. But the Obama administration, boosted by the two victories that they just had about Obamacare and same-sex marriage, sees this as the third and the final one. And they have been really willing to make a number of concessions, as far as we understand, because we only know from rumor, about to the other side, which also could encourage the Iranians to keep asking for more and more. Let's just focus on one quick thing: sanctions. sanctions relief has been estimated by people in the know that it could mean as much as $100 to $150 billion to the Iranians. Now, that would be a lot of money even to the Americans. But when you remember that the Iranian economy is only $400 billion, that's enormous capabilities to do many of the things they want. So from the Iranian perspective, they're going to want to argue past any deadline, is safe in the notion, which could be correct or incorrect, that this administration will continue to make compromises and concessions to them, but they certainly aim to find out.
That is Jonathan Edelman, a scholar at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. We turn our attention now to the Greece financial crisis. Country's cabinet decided that Greek banks would remain closed for 6 business days and restrictions would be imposed on cash withdrawals. For the past couple of days, Greeks have been rushing to withdraw money across the country following Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras's weekend decision to call a referendum on creditor proposals for Greek reforms in return for some bailout funding. Mr. Tsipras blamed the Euro finance ministers for their decision to reject a request for the bailout program, which expires on June 30th, for it to be extended. A $1.8 billion payment is due. That would go to the International Monetary Fund tomorrow, but that might be missed. For some analysis, VOA asked Patrick Chauvinec, chief strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management, how things got to this point.
I think if we had been talking about debt forgiveness or structural reform or even a controlled Greek exit from the euro back in 2010, a lot of things would be possible that now don't appear to be at all possible. And what we're likely to get is none of those things, and instead a very disorganized Greek default and perhaps exit from the euro.
And then we asked just how serious that would be.
You know, Greece is a pretty small economy, even just within Europe, but the problems that exist in Greece and the contentious issues between Greece and the rest of Europe, particularly the creditor countries of Europe, they exist in other countries as well, in Spain, in Portugal, even in Italy. So the concern is that whatever happens in Greece sets a precedent, whether that is that there's debt forgiveness and that creates a wave of demands for debt to be wiped out, or whether that takes the form of a default or even an exit from the euro. So whatever happens in Greece, the concern is not just Greece, it's the precedent that it sets for the rest of European economies that are under stress.
That is Patrick Chauvinec, chief strategist for Silvercrest Asset Management. Still ahead, a major decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. We're coming to you from Washington. Burundi holds controversial parliamentary elections today amid weeks of persistent violence over President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon added his voice to growing calls for Burundi's election to be postponed. And the African Union said Sunday it would not act as an observer of today's balloting because conditions were unsuitable for free, fair, transparent, and credible elections. Opposition says it will boycott the parliamentary elections and a presidential vote later on July 15th, saying it would be possible to hold, would not be possible to hold, an election that's fair. And on the eve of today's vote, the parliamentary head, Pierre Ntavanyuma, said he had fled to Belgium due to the violence in his country, saying he fears for his life. The deputy vice president and members of the Election Commission and Constitutional Court left the country earlier. At least two people died in violence late Saturday into Sunday in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Critics of President Nkurunziza say that he is violating the two-term limit in the Constitution and the accords that ended Burundi's civil war. Constitutional Court said the president is eligible to run again because he was elected by parliament, not voters, for his first five-year term back in 2005. Mr. Nkurunziza's bid for re-election triggered a failed coup attempt last month. Unrest has also forced more than 100,000 Burundians to flee to neighboring countries. At least five people were killed, several others wounded, and a suicide bombing outside a hospital happened on the outskirts of the Nigerian Borno State capital of Maiduguri late Saturday. Officials Sunday said that as many as two would-be bombers attempted to gain entry to the hospital, but were denied entry and detonated explosives outside the building. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the city has been a frequent target of the Boko Haram insurgency, which is blamed for at least 15,000 deaths over the past 6 years. Interior ministers of Britain, France, and Germany will reportedly visit the seaside Imperial Marhaba Hotel south of Tunisia's capital following Friday's deadly attack that killed at least 38 foreigners, including 15 Britons, and an attack claimed by the Islamic State group. North African country has deployed hundreds of security personnel around the town of Sousse, a popular tourist destination, to patrol the hotels, the beaches, and archaeological sites. Thousands of tourists, though, have left the country, but others are afraid to leave their hotels, including this British tourist, Gemma Harris.
We've come down to get home, 3 days on the run. They won't get us home. There's no extra flights. It's only extra seats on already scheduled flights. We don't feel safe here at all. We don't feel safe here at all. I've took 2 weeks off work to come here to relax, to have a holiday, and I'm absolutely petrified. What is going to happen next? Are my kids' lives at risk being here in this country? We don't want to be here, and we're not the only family that don't want to be here either.
One attacker had been identified while a manhunt is on nationwide for possible accomplices. A prime minister, Habib Asid, is closing dozens of mosques outside state control and charged in inciting violence. Friday's attack was the second aimed at foreign tourists, following the March attack at the Bardot Museum in Tunis, in which at least 20 foreigners and a Tunisian security guard were killed. Unknown gunmen on Sunday briefly occupied the southern Malian town of Fakola, just north of the border with Ivory Coast, before they were driven off to security forces. The number of casualties is uncertain, but the attackers could be the same ones who attacked the villages of Massini in the Sikasso region earlier this month. The attack came after a northern rebel alliance led by ethnic Tuaregs signed a peace agreement with the government aimed at ending violence in Mali's northern region. One other story from that region, representatives of Libya's rival governments met face-to-face Sunday for the first time at the latest round of UN-mediated peace talks in Morocco. It happened in a move seen as an important step in forming a unity government. For months now, the UN has tried to broker a compromise to being years of chaos to an end following the 2011 ouster of the dictator Mohamed Muammar Gaddafi. The draft agreement is fourth such proposal offered by the UN envoy Bernardino León. In the United States on Friday, the Supreme Court decided to legalize same-sex marriage throughout the country. VOA's Michael Bowman introduces us to a same-sex couple that will benefit from the high court ruling and to a Christian scholar who is apprehensive about its potential consequences for America's faith community.
Gay rights backers celebrated outside the Supreme Court Friday, including Lena Hernandez.
Just such a great day. Such a great day for us, for me and my wife, for everyone all over the place. Like, I'm so excited, and these are tears of happiness. Like,
Hernandez and Candy Cintron married last year when same-sex unions became legal in the state of Virginia.
When we decided to get married, I was betting on for forever. So she has a very long time she has to deal with me.
I'd gladly take that.
An adverse high court ruling would have thrown into question the legality of their marriage, something they both treasure.
Just makes you sort of legal, make you count.
Then you can put the letters.
The couple is expecting a baby. Without a marriage license, Cintron's legal rights as a spouse, as well as the child's second parent, could be challenged.
We're both very vested in having a kid. We are a couple. If you go anywhere else where that's not recognized, then where does that leave me?
Now that is one less concern for the couple as they prepare for motherhood.
It's an overwhelming feeling, but I don't want to be in this with anybody but her, so I don't feel like I'm doing it by myself at all, which is very nice.
This is a particularly difficult ruling for the Catholic Church.
Catholic University scholar Chad Pecknold says the court decision conflicts with centuries of church teachings.
Same-sex marriage is in fact, not definitionally marriage, but something which seeks to imitate marriage.
He worries the legal empowerment of gay people will erode religious freedoms in America and constrain the church's outreach to society. Debate about same-sex marriage may go on, but from a legal standpoint, the issue is settled. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And VOA's Michael Lippin is here now joining us to tell us about what's being said on social media. So, Michael, just how many people are out there talking about this Supreme Court decision on gay marriage?
Well, Steve, just to get a sense of the numbers of people tweeting in support of the U.S. legalization of gay marriage, all you need to do is look at how many times they've tweeted the most popular pro-gay marriage hashtag, Love Wins. The use of Love Wins has been encouraged by Twitter, which automatically displays a rainbow flag in the shape of a heart inside the tweet whenever someone includes that hashtag. Now, the Topsy Analytics site shows that hashtag Love Wins has been used more than 500,000 times in the past day and almost 7 million times in the last week. Those are huge numbers for any hashtag. Now, on Sunday, many gay marriage supporters were focused on gay pride parades being held across the U.S. and overseas. U.S. media say hundreds of thousands of people attended those events on Sunday, and one of the biggest took place in New York City. That parade had its own hashtag, which trended on Twitter, hashtag NYCPride2015. And if you do a Twitter search for it, you'll find tons of colorful photos and videos from that parade.
And Michael, how have the U.S. opponents of gay marriage been using the social media to express themselves?
Well, they certainly haven't been shy to express disappointment with the Supreme Court ruling or to reaffirm their belief that marriage is still a union of one man and one woman. Some of them have been using the hashtag 1M1W, as in the numeral 1 followed by the letter M for man, and then the numeral 1 followed by W for woman. But that hashtag has only been used a few thousand times on Twitter, paling in comparison to Love Wins. Now, gay marriage critics have been much more vocal on Facebook, leaving comments on pages of groups like the U.S. National Organization for Marriage. That group posted a photo of a bride and groom kissing, superimposed with this message: "Traditional marriage, God ordained it, nature reveals it, science affirms it." Now, Americans who support that view also have been interacting on the Facebook page of Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, who has been one of the strongest conservative critics of the Supreme Court decision. Huckabee has drawn much praise from those Americans for posting a series of messages explaining how he would fight the ruling and defend traditional marriage. Steve?
Many thanks, Michael. That's VOA's Michael Lippin. A reminder, everyone, we have a new Twitter site for VOA's International Edition. Check us out. Our Twitter handle is @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Some 8,000 light years from Earth, in the constellation Cygnus, a binary system known as V404 Cygni is bursting with activity for the first time in 26 years. This system is made up of a black hole and a star that orbit each other. The black hole is also devouring matter from its companion star. The binary system caught the attention of astronomers in June when the Burst Alert Telescope, mounted on NASA's Swift satellite, detected a sudden burst of gamma rays. Scientists from all over the world have since been monitoring the black hole and its companion star with ground-based and space telescopes. The sudden burst of activity is thought to be triggered when gathering material surrounding the black hole grows to a point that forces a dramatic change in its feeding mechanism. The last time this binary system was this active and bright was back in 1989. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Good to have you with us. You know, there's a new movie out there looking at love and violence. It's set against the backdrop of the drug empire of Colombia's Pablo Escobar. David Byrd is here now with a look at Escobar: Paradise Lost.
Depending on who you ask, former Colombian cocaine cartel leader Pablo Escobar was the devil incarnate, a man who cared for the downtrodden, or an international criminal. There's no denying that at one time, Escobar, known for his violent ways of handling those who opposed him, was one of the world's most wanted fugitives. His Medellin cartel shipped tons of cocaine to the United States and Europe before he was shot dead by Colombian security forces in 1993. In a new film, Escobar: Paradise Lost, director Andrea DiStefano has Oscar-winning actor Benicio del Toro playing the former drug lord. At the film's premiere, DiStefano said he didn't want to portray Escobar as some kind of romantic anti-hero. He just wanted to tell a good story.
I was a story that was told to me and inspired me to write this film. I wasn't particularly in love with Pablo Escobar. It was just, I thought that was a story like that could make an interesting thriller, a movie I would like to go and see at the movie theater.
That story has a young surfer from Canada, Nick, played by Josh Hutcherson, who's best known as PETA in the Hunger Games franchise. He moves to Colombia with his older brother, where he falls in love with Pablo Escobar's niece, played by Claudia Trasek.
All of you foreigners, come here and think that you found paradise. But I see what is wrong with it. We do charity work for poor communities.
That's great. Who's we?
My uncle. I work for him.
Oh, Uncle Pablo.
Maria is like a daughter to me. Do you love her?
Yes. Absolutely.
Benicio del Toro says that playing someone as notorious as Pablo Escobar was fascinating, because he had to learn about the former drug lord to interpret the character.
A lot of the moments that he picked of Escobar were kind of like taking place in actual, real moments that happened in his life. When he was running for office, opening a clinic, and like the first time Josh's character sees him, he's opening this clinic for the people, for the poor people. So there was all this stuff when he goes to jail at the end that is, you know, that is... He controlled that jail at that moment.
Del Toro is no stranger to playing controversial men. He played Argentine guerrilla leader Ernesto Che Guevara in the 2008 biopic Che. For this film, the Oscar winner says that he learned that his character had many sides and wasn't just a gangster or a thug.
That was one of the things that I kind of like. So when we see Escobar, we see the truth, his love for his family, his... We see him as a family man. That's how Josh's character sees him. So there's truth to the character of Escobar.
Josh Hutcherson says that his character is an amalgamation of a historical person or persons, but the story did not really happen that way.
Nick wasn't a real character. There was a, I guess, there was some secondhand account of something that worked for Pablo, that there was like a pool guy that was kind of outside the circle that sort of got brought in that wasn't Colombian. So through that, I think Andrea found the inspiration for Nick, and then kind of used Nick as a metaphor for the Colombian people sort of being romanticized by Pablo and brought into this world in this beautiful way with the caring, loving side, and then just giving it to him.
Hutcherson's character has to make some difficult choices to keep his family safe, and he also doesn't know if Uncle Pablo is there to help him or to kill him. Escobar Paradise Lost is rated R for violence and for language. I'm David Byrd.
I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love's illusions that I recall. I really don't know.
That is American singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell singing her hit, Both Sides Now. Mitchell's friend and conservator, Leslie Morris, went on the internet over the weekend to say an aneurysm had sent the folk singer to the hospital back in March. It was the first significant details on Mitchell's health status. Some had witnessed an ambulance moving away from her home. Leslie Morris was appointed Joni Mitchell's conservator back in May when a judge decided that Mitchell wouldn't make any health decisions or could not make any clear health decisions on her own and had no relatives to serve as her conservator. Mitchell is, as many know, a rock and roll Hall of Famer and has won 8 Grammys for her many songs. American singer Kanye West declared himself the greatest living rock star on the planet. Happened over the weekend at Britain's Glastonbury Festival, but it didn't prevent a prankster from coming on stage to rap along with the great rapper. Lee Nelson, a British comedian, said he just had to do it. And a lot of people remembered how it had been years before when West had done the same thing to Taylor Swift. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell joined U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash, Acting Assistant Secretary of State Judith Garber, and other leaders on June 19th to destroy more than 1 ton of confiscated elephant ivory in New York's Times Square, sending a clear message that the United States will not tolerate wildlife crimes that threaten to wipe out the African elephant and a host of other species around the globe. The crush was conducted in partnership with the state of New York, the Wildlife Conservation Society, and New York State Senator Brad Hoilman. Secretary Jewell, who serves as co-chair with Secretary of State Kerry and Attorney General Lynch of the President's Task Force on Combating Wildlife Trafficking, joined Director Ash and thousands of onlookers who witnessed an industrial rock crusher generously donated by Powerscreen crush raw and carved ivory tusks and statues. Secretary Jewell said the ivory crush serves as a stark reminder to the rest of the world that the United States will not tolerate wildlife crimes, especially against iconic and endangered animals. The message is loud and clear. This administration will stop the poachers in their tracks, stop the profits, and work with our international partners to protect our global natural heritage. The Times Square ivory crush builds on momentum generated by the Fish and Wildlife Service's initial destruction of 6 tons of contraband ivory in November 2013. Since then, 9 governments have followed suit to destroy ivory. Campaigns to reduce demand for ivory both domestically and overseas and to strengthen international laws and enforcement have further elevated the issue of wildlife trafficking globally. regardless of their country of origin. We all lose if elephants, rhinos, tigers, and other iconic animals disappear. The only way we will save them is together through a concerted global effort to end the scourge of wildlife trafficking and the devastation it brings to these animals, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash. The United States, he said, underscored its commitment to winning this fight, and we call on all nations to join us by destroying their confiscated ivory stockpiles, enacting and enforcing strong regulations protecting wildlife from illegal trade, and reducing demand.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours.